Public Library, this is Storytime for Grown-Ups. Stories have the power to inspire and change us. Being read to stimulates our brains, expands our imaginations, and is just plain fun. I am Margie Kohlbacher. Welcome to Season 2, Episode 8. Today's story is from an author we've heard and enjoyed in a previous podcast, Max Brand. One of his earliest westerns, this is an offbeat yet classic gunfighter showdown. Sit back, listen, and enjoy.
The Fear of Morgan the Fearless by Max Brand. Pete's was a blessing. After you footed it all over the city through the day, interviewed bored celebrities, and listened to the barking of a city editor, quiet is a blessing. Pete's was quiet. Of course, there was the roar of the elevated where it turned down from the Bowery just outside the door, and there was the rattling and the rumble of the surface traffic as well. But for all that, Pete's was quiet. The lights were dim and yellowish. The hissing of frying meat in the little kitchen at the end of the room was a soothing sound, and the feel of the sawdust rubbing underfoot was pleasant and soothing. Helms discovered the place. Helms was fat and subdued from a long career as a copy reader, but he was always discovering things. He mentioned the place to Crosby and me, and after that, the three of us rarely missed our early morning half hour at Pete's. I don't know why he chose Crosby and me. I was only a cub and hardly knew him. Crosby was a star. I suppose it was because both of us came from the West, and Pete's was decidedly Western in atmosphere. A lariat sagged over the coat hangers, the length of the room on one side. On the facing wall, high out of reach, hung a richly ornamented Mexican sombrero. Near it was a pair of silver spurs in a glass case. The spurs had belonged to Morgan. In fact, Morgan was almost like an invisible personality in the room. Pete talked of him constantly. We loved to hear the big fellow tell tales of his favorite desperado, and almost every night he gave us a new chapter. Morgan the Fearless had performed as many heroic actions as there are pages in a book. He had bullied saloons full of gunfighters. He had held up countless stagecoaches. He had plundered safes and had shot up whole towns. The day was not finished until we had heard of an exploit of Morgan's. We were never disappointed. At that hour, there were few customers in the place. Pete used to bring us our order and then come and take the other chair at our table. He never gave until he received. He was hungry for lurid stories, and among the three of us, we always managed to give him some choice stuff. Crosby had stored away 1,000 stories of revolting crimes. After a while, we fell back upon him altogether. Pete would listen with both elbows spread out on the table, and his big fingers running through his drooping mustache, and into his eyes would become a peculiar dreaminess. Then he would talk of Morgan the Fearless, stimulating his memory or his imagination from time to time with noisy sips from a tall mug of beer. His language was a singular mix of Western and New York slang. But an end came to both Pete and Morgan the Fearless. It was all on account of Helms, who asked the foolish question. Helms had an almost feminine curiosity. He asked Pete to tell us what had finally become of Morgan. Afterward, we held it against Helms, but that night, I suppose, Crosby and I were equally curious. After all, it was a natural question. For according to Pete, the fearless Morgan had already passed through enough adventures to secure the fame of 12 ordinary desperados.
The end of Morgan? Said Pete rather vaguely, running his pale glance from one face to the other.
He did have an end, didn't he? Queried Helms.
Well, he sure had an end, said Pete slowly.
This is a special occasion, you know, insisted Helms. Crosby is going out to Chicago tomorrow, and I think we ought to finish the last installment before he leaves. Don't you, Pete?
The force of this appeal was manifest at once in Pete's eyes. Crosby was his favorite. There was no doubt of that.
All right, said Helms, spreading his elbows out on the table in a restful attitude of attention. Let's have the death of Morgan.
Pete's eyes wandered to a corner of the room and stayed there a moment.
Well, he did die, right? Asked Helms.
Aye, said Pete. Old Morgan's dead, right enough.
We all waited with a curious intentness, knowing that the story was about to come. I could see Pete's plump face wrinkling a little with pain, or perhaps it was from the mere effort of memory.
It was down at Barclays, he began. I've told you about the place.
Barclays was the road inn, wasn't it? Asked Helms.
Yep.
That was the saloon where Morgan drank a quart of firewater one night on a bet, wasn't it?
Yep,
said Pete, growing more cheerful as he thought back to his older tales.
Well, what happened? Asked Crosby. They'd put up with Morgan for a long time, went on Pete. Sometimes they'd get together posses and chase him through the hills. All they got was a sight of him ducking around a curve, a long ways ahead, or maybe some bullets kicking up the dust just in front of them, and telling them to keep back, sort of polite. That was the way things stood for a long time, but Bridgewater was getting bigger and bigger, and finally it got to be a city, and they had their own mayor and all that. That was how it started. He shrugged his fat shoulders and frowned over his beer again.
Well, he went on, one night Morgan holds up a stage coming into Bridgewater on the Caswell Road. It was the first stage he'd stuck up for nigh onto 2 months. That was the funny part of it. He just did it sort of for fun, because excitement was getting kind of low around there, and you can all buy in on the fact that Morgan, sure enough, loved excitement.
We gathered that all right, grinned Crosby.
I thought his finish came in the saloon, not holding up a stage, queried Helms.
Pete regarded him with equal parts of sadness and vexation.
I'm trying to tell it from the start, he said, because if there hadn't been no holdup, there wouldn't have been no finish to Morgan in the saloon. You see, when he stuck up the stage, all he got was a couple of pocket watches which stopped running in a few days and a handful of silver money. That was all he got and all he did, except to shoot the ear off the near leader as the stage was coming around the bend and to throw a fright into the mayor's daughter. That was how the trouble began. That throwing a fright into the mayor's daughter.
Ah, said Helms. I knew there'd be a woman in it. Was she a looker, Pete?
She wasn't much of anything, said Pete in his slow voice. Her hair was light and her skin was dark, and the most she had in the way of variety was a string of freckles running across her nose. Nobody ever looked twice at her in all her life, I reckon, except in her father, and her father was mayor of Bridgewater. He stopped again for his noisy recourse to the beer mug. Her father was built bulging, like a wheat sack that ain't filled tight and sags in the middle. That was what old man Craig looked like. He ought to have been good-natured, he was that fat, but he wasn't. He was the kind of man who keeps hammering the hollow of one hand with his other fist while he's talking to you. That was how he got elected mayor of Bridgewater. He talked them out of their votes. He talked so much, nobody else got a chance to be heard. Well, as I was saying, he was fat enough to have been good-natured, but he wasn't. He had a sort of ingrowing grudge against the world. First thing he did when he got into office was to get them to raise the price of the liquor licenses. I leave it to you.
What kind of a man is that? Pete threw out his hands, palm up in a gesture of appeal. One after another, we shook our heads in solemn agreement that such a mayor was not a man at all. Yep, he went on. He sure had a grudge against everything in the world except his daughter. And his daughter was the one who got scared and squealed and fainted like a young fool when Morgan held up the stage, as quiet and gentlemanlike as any stage was ever held up in the Rockies. So she come home and she had hysterics all the way into Bridgewater. That was 10 miles. But it didn't use her up none. She still had plenty of strength left to moan and holler around her dad. And the old man got terrible sore. And the next day he fired the sheriff and told him he was no good. He wasn't no good as a sheriff, but he had a winning way with him, and the mayor got more unpopular than ever after he'd done it. But there wasn't hardly no way of disputing the mayor. He was right. The sheriff let Morgan keep cavorting around the country, and when he went out and chased him with a posse, everyone knew that the only reason Morgan didn't stop and hold up the sheriff and his posse was because he had a sense of humor. Well, the mayor, he got some of the leading citizens of Bridgewater together, leaving out the saloon keepers, and he told them that these things would have to stop. And when they asked him what, he said, Morgan. They all agreed with him, and then they asked how. But the mayor was mad. He said he was going to send away for the best gunfighter in the United States and get him up there after Morgan. The prominent citizens, they all laughed and said there wasn't no one man in the world could round up Morgan, and that the gunfighter had better be measured for a coffin before he started to work. But the next thing folks knew, they heard that the mayor had sent to Austin, down in Texas, for a sure enough gun puller, a fellow known all through northern New Mexico as the best living imitation of the devil. Buck Christie was his name. He drained more of the beer, with us sitting in rapt attention. I don't know how much the mayor guaranteed to Christie if he'd come up and corral Morgan, but anyway, one day, a little skinny runt with a pale face and a manner that said, excuse me, before he opened his mouth, this here runt got off the stage at Bridgewater and went up to the mayor's office. The mayor was sitting there with his feet on top of the roll-top desk. He was all through his day's work and was trimming his fingernails. Are you the mayor? Asked this little guy. Mayor slants an eye at him and spits liberal into the place where the spittoon ought to have been, but wasn't. I am, says he. I'm Buck Christie, said the stranger, and held out his hand. The mayor, he didn't make any move. He just sat there and popped his eyes. You're who? Says he. I'm Buck Christie, says this man with a pale face. You're hell, says the mayor, sort of coming to life. Christie'd eat 3 or 4 like you before breakfast, sort of as an appetizer. Now, mayor was a big man, and this guy was small, and there was a couple of clerks in the outer office who heard and saw all this. But they didn't see anything more, because the little guy, he turned around and locked the door. Afterward, they heard a tolerable lot of noise in the office. Pretty soon, the noise stopped, and the door opens, and the little guy comes out, looking as pale and sad as ever. Behind him was the mayor. He was kind of red in the face, and his collar was missing. Also, a large part of his right sleeve. Boys, says he, speaking sort of cheerful, this here stranger is Buck Christie, that I reckon all of you've heard a lot about.
Christy. He just stood there and looked around at them, and somehow they all forgot to grin. They all come up and said how glad they was to meet him. Pete sighed deeply. That was how Buck Crispy came to Bridgewater, he went on. And that was the beginning of the end of Morgan.
Do you mean to say the little guy finished Morgan? Queried Helms. I thought Morgan was a big guy.
He was, said Pete.
And Christy finished him?
Asked Helms again. Pete shrugged his shoulders and frowned. Go ahead, Pete, broke in Crosby.
And you shut up, Helms. You're plain spoiling the best story we've heard.
Helms relaxed into silence, and Pete resumed the narrative.
Of course, everyone around those parts heard about it right off. All the men out of Bridgewater started betting on it like it was a horse race. Harry Everett, he was the guy that Morgan found in the blizzard and carried home. Harry Everett, he rode into Bridgewater and offered 20-1 that Morgan would make a fool of Buck Christy.
Christy, he heard what was happening, and he went down to Barclays where Harry was hanging out.
How much do you want to bet again me? Says he, going up to Harry. Anything you got to offer, says Harry, as quick as a flash, he being a real sport with an awful comeback when he was called.
Well, says Christy, I got 1,000 that ain't doing a thing, and I don't know anything I'd rather do with it than this. So they made the bet regular, and they wrote it down and got the mayor to come and witness it. That was the first time the mayor ever come into Barclays.
Well, if there was considerable excitement about this guy Christy before, it didn't let down none after that $20,000 bet was laid. Nobody talked of nothing else.
But Christy, he didn't move, didn't take to the trail, just sat there in Barclays.
The mayor went to Christy one day and told him that he had to do something quick because everybody, including himself, expected him to do something besides laying bets on himself.
There ain't nothing for me to do, says Christy in his soft sort of voice.
Pretty soon, Morgan will come to me.
Why should I go out to him?
How do you mean Morgan will come to you?
He'll come to me because he's proud, says Christy.
That's what Morgan'll do. He'll come to me because he's proud.
And did Morgan come to him? Asked Helms.
Well, now I'm getting to that, said Pete.
He stopped again to drain the last of his beer.
Go on, urged Crosby.
Christy spent all the time he was awake in Barclays, he resumed. When anyone asked him why he spent so much time there, he said that he was keeping long office hours for the sake of Morgan.
Do you really think Morgan will come in here where there's always a crowd? They'd go on to ask Christy.
Sure, Christy would say. The crowd won't stop Morgan any. He'll hear after a while that I'm waiting for him, and then he'll come in.
And Morgan came in?
We said it all three together in a sort of awed whisper. The thing was beginning to grow ghostly.
He came in, said Pete, pausing for effect.
It was pretty near 12 o'clock at night. There was about 15 or 20 fellows in Barclay's big room that night. They sat around and played cards, and some of them now and then went up to the bar and got a drink at the end of a hand, because there was a lot of money going about, and the winners was treating pretty general. Most of them had been playing all evening. They was sort of tired outside and heated up inside, the way you get when you've been playing cards a long time. Nothing seems to happen except what comes in the game, and the rest of the world, it just sort of fades away and doesn't matter. Maybe you fellas know how that is.
We sure do, said Crosby with feeling, who had lost half a week's pay at stud poker the night before.
There was one funny thing about that room, went on Pete in a solemn voice.
There was a big gasoline lamp that hung from the center of the wall, right over the bar. It was a mighty bright lamp, but right under it, where the body of the lamp came, there was a sort of a shadow that fell on the floor. All the rest of the room was lighted up as bright as day, almost. Well, the boys was there playing and drinking, as I said. And all at once, the door opens quick, and there stands Morgan, with his two guns out and covering the crowd. There wasn't anything said. Somebody looked around and then got right up with his hands over his head. Then, one by one, they all stood up and put their hands over their heads. "Boys," said Morgan, "I hope I ain't disturbing you, and I won't make you uncomfortable with no long call. I ain't here to rob anybody, not even you, Mr. Barkley. All I want is this guy who was betting $1,000 that he would make a fool of me. Which of you is Buck Christie?" "I'm Christie," says the little guy, and with that he stepped out and stopped in the circle of shadow under the lamp. Now, Christie's gun was hanging down limp at his side, the full length of his arm, and both of Morgan's guns was looking him right in the face. "I got something to say to you, Morgan, and I think it's only fair to the boys here that they should hear what I've got to say." "Well," says Morgan, wondering what was coming next, but willing to listen. He was that pleased to have the drop on his man out of both barrels. "I just want to tell you and the boys that you ain't no bad man, Morgan." I guess that sort of stunned Morgan and everyone else in the room. "You've just been kidding yourself and the rest of these here innocent people, Morgan. Understand?" Morgan didn't understand, nor nobody else. They wouldn't have understood if they heard it read to them in the same words out of the Bible. They saw that Christie was pulling some sort of a game, but they couldn't make out what it was. "You've done some pretty nice little jobs," went on Christie. "I ain't denying that, but it wasn't because you was any bad man, Morgan. Why, you ain't got any more heart than a whip pup." Morgan, he just stood there and made his eyes bigger so he could look at him better. He thought maybe that Christie was trying some sort of a new humor on him. So he waited a little while longer. And when he got through waiting, it was too late. Pete broke off suddenly and dropped his face into his hands with a groan. "Steady, man," said Crosby, leaning over and putting a hand on Pete's shoulder. "We know Morgan was your friend, but let's hear the rest of it." Pete raised his face and began again, but his voice was unsteady. "There they stood," he went on. "There was Christie with his gun hanging at his side, and there was Morgan with both sights full on Christie's face, like this." He stretched both his hands before him with the elbows resting on the table, and his hands took shape as if they were quivering strongly about the handles of two revolvers. And his face changed too. It grew harder, and he scowled steadily into space as if he were narrowing his eyes to take a careful bead through the sights. "And Christie," he went on talking in a soft voice, said Pete, his own words dropping into a singular drawling monotone, which made my flesh creep. "You've been doing a lot of things more than you've got the heart for, Morgan," he says. And he was looking Morgan straight in the eye all the time. Now, he had a mighty pale face, but as he stood there looking, Morgan forgot the face. All he could see was them eyes burning at him out of the shadow under that there gasoline lamp. And he kept looking and looking. You get the urge to do some wild things on the spur of the moment, says Christy. And sometimes you do them pretty well, but you ain't got no heart to stand up to a real man face to face. He went silent for a minute, just looking steady at Morgan, and then the sights of Morgan's guns began to waver just a little from side to side. It wasn't much of a waver. Maybe holding the gun steady in one position made his hands begin to sort of get unsteady. Anyway, the guns began to stir, though they never stirred enough to get the bead off of Christy. "For instance," went on Christy, "you're going to fail with me tonight, Morgan, because tonight, for the first time in your life, you're up against a real man. Understand?" "Yes." "You do understand, Morgan. You're beginning to weaken now. I can see. Everybody in this room can see it. You're beginning to weaken." All the room was dead quiet, as if they was expecting some move from Morgan, and he couldn't make up his mind what it might be. And still, Christy's voice went on in that damned monotone like, "You never dreamed that you could ever fall down on a job, did you, Morgan? But tonight, you're getting weak. You ain't sure of yourself. You don't find it very nice to stand here and look a man in the eye. Why, it's like I said, you ain't got no more heart than a whipped pup, Morgan. Not the heart of a squirming, scared pup. Not you." And somehow, Morgan got to saying those words over and over to himself. He kept saying them over and over in his mind. "You ain't got no more heart than a whipped pup." And then those two guns of Morgan's, they began to drop little by little. They dropped to Christie's breast and stayed a long time over his heart. And then they dropped until they was pointing at Christie's feet. So there they was, them two, Morgan big and Christy little, with Christie's eyes holding on to Morgan's and Morgan's eyes wavering but sticking to Christie's eyes that was burning into him out of the shadow. And as they stood there, someone in the corner began to whisper sort of hoarse, like he was saying his prayers. "My God." And then over again, "My God, my God." If you ever heard the sound of water dripping regular into a well, that's the way those words came into Morgan's ears. And then something began to come up in his throat and choke him, and he felt his eyes getting dizzy and dim. Then Christy, he laid his own gun over on the bar, slow, without ever moving his eyes from Morgan. And then he made one slow step, and then he took Morgan's guns out of his hands, one after the other, very slow and careful. And Morgan just stood there and didn't make a move, with his hands still out in front of him, as if he was still holding the guns in them. Then Morgan, he sort of woke up with a start, and the room got all bright to him all at once. He saw what had happened and saw his own guns in Christy's hands. He made a sort of a jump for them, but Christy, he didn't shoot. He just made a step back and swung one gun so that the muzzle of it hit Morgan over the left eye. It didn't knock him down, but it cut him bad, and it was enough to stop him and send him back another pace. and that's how it ended. But what became of him? Helms insisted. Did they arrest him? Did he serve a term? And how did he die?
They tried to arrest him, said Pete. But Christie wouldn't let them. He held them off, and Morgan went outside and got on his horse and rode away.
Rode where? Asked Helms.
To hell, said Pete, and he stood up. It's closing time. We got up and went silently and hastily out of the room. The doors closed behind us as if they were shutting on a death. We never saw Pete again. Never went back down to his place after that night, and eventually he closed down. We heard he'd moved back west somewhere. But one thing I always remember, something I hadn't noticed until that last night, Pete had gone deadly pale after he had finished Morgan's story, and his pallor revealed, clear as anything, a scar on his forehead. Over his left eye.
Thank you for listening today. Be sure to join us for our next episode of Mind Expanding Tales.
Storytime for Grownups is recorded at Elmhurst Public Library's Creative Studio Lab. Directed and edited by Jeremy Slayton. Produced and hosted by Margie Kohlbacher. Stories narrated by Duard Mosley. Works read in this podcast may be protected under copyright law. These podcasts are reserved for the education of library patrons only. Elmhurst Public Library receives no commercial gain from these recordings. No unauthorized further dissemination of these works is permitted.